You're listening to BFM 89.9, the business station. The BFM Breakfast Grill. Top interviews you can't afford to miss. Presented by the CIMB Group.
Good morning. This is Xiaomi with Daryl Webber, Secretary General of the Roundtable of Sustainable Palm Oil on the Breakfast Grill today. In 2011, palm oil consumption was 49.7 million tonnes, and this is estimated to rise to 60 million by 2015 and 78 million by 2020, bringing the matter of sustainability to the fore. The RSPO is holding an extraordinary general assembly in KL where members will consider the passing of newly revised principles and criteria for the production of certified sustainable palm oil. Some of the key changes proposed include new criteria requiring growers to minimise greenhouse gas emissions from new plantings, companies to implement counter-corruption policies, a policy on human rights to be in place and communicated, and banning the use of forced labour. Daryl, welcome to The Breakfast Grill.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, let's start with the RSPO itself. The RSPO membership currently consists of 38% processors and traders, 36% consumer goods manufacturers, and 15% oil palm growers. The remainder is made up of retailers, environmental conservation NGOs, and social and developmental NGOs. So a large part of the new proposal requires implementation by growers and millers. Since they make up such a small percentage of the RSPO membership, are the affected parties having a real say in the formulation and the revision of these P&Cs?
Absolutely. I think the way the RSPO is structured, it's structured in a way that does not marginalise any of our stakeholder groups. So we have seven stakeholder groups. And if you look at the pie chart that the split that you just quoted, the smallest split is the NGOs there. It's about 3%, I think. Mm-hmm. We have designed our processes to ensure that nobody's marginalised. Despite what you hear outside, I think, and I'd like to stress again and again, we operate beyond democracy. We operate through consensus building. And what does consensus building mean? It means that everybody at the negotiation table must agree before any policy can leave the room, right?
I mean, but is there any merit in saying that actually, say, the NGOs and the growers are so far apart that to bring them into a middle ground takes a lot of pulling?
Absolutely.
On both sides?
Yes.
So is there another way of doing this? Would the NGOs be better off speaking directly to government, say, who clearly have the teeth and the power to pass new laws that they could impose on growers?
I think if you look at a trend globally, in fact, I just came back from a UN conference just about voluntary standards like what we have. Mm. The trend is governments recognise that they are always going to be behind the curve in terms of innovation, right? And you don't blame them. The government is designed to do that. They have to go to the lowest common denominator and all that. So I think in this multi-stakeholder initiative like ours, we want to move fast. We ensure we don't leave the stakeholders out. We ensure we give them a fair platform. And my job as a Secretary General, and in the simplest way to explain, my job as a Secretary General is to ensure the table is large enough, ensure that the chairs are filled around the table, ensure that every person sitting in the chair gets a chance to speak, and ensure that their voice is heard. Mm-hmm. So that's my job. And the rules in the RSPO is as such. Nobody gets marginalized. And I think that seems the best way forward. And if you really, really think about it, to solve the issues of the industry today, industry faces today, the industry needs to get these issues coming in from all areas, right?
Yeah.
So from all sectors. Otherwise, you won't know what the issues are, and therefore you can't deal with it. And how better to do it than in a round table where you get input from social NGOs, environmental NGOs, retailers, everybody along the supply chain, all the interest groups.
Yeah.
So you collect all the issues and then you trash it out and brainstorm and find a solution to all the issues. That's probably the best way.
But how frequently do these principles and criteria actually affect people further down the production line apart from the growers and the millers?
Right. So in our code of conduct, you are supposed to have parallel standards if you're outside of the standards. So, for example, the retailers or the manufacturers needs to have their own rules that are not weaker than the standards. So they have to show.
Yeah. But I mean, arguably, if you talk about environmental issues and deforestation and stuff, it really doesn't, it's not really going to apply to many other people apart from the growers.
No. It does. For example, the likes of Unilever, if you see their scorecard, they promise to, they want to reduce their footprint, environmental footprint, by half.
Mm-hmm.
By, I think, 2050, I think. Despite the fact that they'll be growing double by then.
Yep.
And they have looked at their supply chain, and they have looked at which are the areas that have the greatest environmental impact, for example. So they look at water, they look at forest, they look at all these sort of things. And for each of these indicators, they have strategies, and they implement it down the supply chain. So they are doing a lot of work.
Okay.
Maybe
not specific to palm oil, but to their entire manufacturing process.
So okay. You know, every large brand company I know are tackling these issues now at their manufacturing plants and all the way down to their supply chain, upwards and downwards. So,
So, you know, you would have had quite a few roundtables to have come up with this revision of the PNCs, right? So, I mean, what level of agreement do you need from your members in order to pass these things?
Well, we need the majority, usually.
So a simple majority of more than 50%.
Simple majority. But what we do to ensure... So how policies are developed in the RSPL, one must understand, yeah? So at the lowest level, it starts from what we call a task force.
Mm-hmm.
So a task force deliberates, and we must have balanced representation, so the growers are there and all that. And they must agree. If there's no consensus, it does not get up to the board.
Okay.
And at the board level, again, you must have consensus
again. Okay.
And then it gets brought up to the General Assembly to vote. And usually, most of the time, the General Assembly, the members are confident. Those members who know our process are confident that due process have been done, and they usually voted in. Usually. Resolutions that don't get voted in usually tries to bypass the consensus building process.
Yeah.
And that's why it never gets voted in.
Okay. But at one point, you know, probably a couple of years ago now, you had mentioned that you were struggling to get the right level of expertise to be sat around at the round table. You weren't having enough bums on seats.
Yeah.
As such.
That's true.
Is that still a problem now?
Not so much of a problem now. So we are getting people on the seats. But I guess it takes time for people to adjust, you know. I think, for example, in this recent standards review, the Malaysian representation was by far the largest representation. So we had balanced representation. So official numbers representing the Malaysian rowers are balanced. So there's a ratio.
Yeah.
But then there were a large number of observers because a lot of the meetings were held in Malaysia. So there were observers looking at their representatives.
Okay.
So people were all informed, and by far Malaysians had the largest numbers. I think what is interesting now is to understand how the representatives inform the rest of their constituents, how they made the decisions. What you hear now is, you know, rumblings of dissatisfaction and all that. I think it's because they don't understand the process, and they don't understand that it took a lot of bravery for Malaysians to represent their constituents on this negotiating table.
Yeah.
And if you have no idea the level of negotiations that goes out, the kind of difficult negotiations that go down. And at the end of the day, I witnessed it throughout. I left with a bittersweet feeling, and I think everybody did. Because, and I guess that's the best form of compromise. Then you know...
You know, you haven't won, you haven't lost.
You've
completely compromised.
Right, so the other stakeholders came with a whole list of wants. And the growers had a list where nobody got everything. So that's a good thing.
Yeah.
If one party walked out happy, I think then the rest of the other stakeholders will probably leave the RSPO. And in today, you will see in one side of the world, the press talks in a different way about this coming extraordinary General Assembly, saying probably the standards are too high. In another part of the world, and lots of the world, saying the standards are too low. On the same issue.
Well, I'm speaking to Daryl Weber, Secretary General of the Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil. After the break, we will continue discussing the effectiveness of the RSPO and broader environmental issues. This is Xiaomi speaking to Daryl Weber, Secretary General of the Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil, on the Breakfast Grill this morning. How effective do you think the RSPO is since inception 2004?
Well, first of all, you have to look at the scale of the issue that we're trying to address. So it's a global commodity. It's never been done before. We're going into areas that nobody done before. There's no roadmap for you to copy. But even then, the indicators of growth, I mean, we double in size almost every year. The amount of production is increasing almost every year, doubling. The uptake is also increasing every year. But there's a lag, and this is what people always bring up. There's a lag between the growth of production and the growth of uptake. A lot of it has to do with a mindset change in terms of how you buy and how you buy a niche product like certified sustainable palm oil. Mm. Certified sustainable palm oil is 15% of global palm oil production. So it cannot be treated like a global commodity. It must be treated as a niche product. And when you're dealing with a niche product, it takes a lot more planning, a lot more alignment along the supply chains, and a lot more, definitely a lot more forward planning, I think. That's
if you look at the number of people who are actually registered with the RSPO, they don't actually make up that large a percentage of the global...
Oh, they do. Do production, they? You mean?
Well, okay, if I just look at the growers, okay, you've got 92 growers registered with the RSPO right now, and they're responsible for 4 million hectares. Yes, that's about 35% of global estates. But their actual certified estate areas is only 1.4 million hectares.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just not a very large proportion of the global area.
Yeah.
But, you know, even if you get these really big players, okay, by number they are small, but they make up a big population. Even if you do get them to comply, what about all the other small players?
Yeah, so that's key. Let me go back to the numbers you just mentioned, right? So 1.4 million hectares represent,
10%.
Less than 10%. But I talk about production numbers. So 15% of all palm oil produced today is certified sustainable palm oil.
Yeah.
That's significant, but it's still a niche, right? Somebody informed me 2 years ago, they did the math, and something like 40% of global production is represented in the RSPO.
Okay.
They did the math, and they look at the membership number, and they look at global production, and I can assume that number is increasing because a lot of these companies now are buying up other companies.
Mm-hmm.
Now, having said that, we don't lose sight of the smaller players. So smallholders, we have certified thousands of smallholders already. Thousands. Those are scheme smallholders. Now we're going on to get independent smallholders certified. So the first ones was last year from Thailand. And this year we're going to see some from Indonesia and some from Malaysia.
Okay.
So those are the, you know, smallholder, reaching out to smallholders is going to be a difficult task and we need help. And this is where I guess governments can play a role to help. And governments are playing a role. We are dealing with... the Malaysian government agency to our outreach to independent smallholders.
Mm-hmm.
We are working with Indonesian agencies to reach out to independent smallholders.
Okay.
And, you know, smallholders will benefit. Interesting, I think, and I just want to say this while I have the opportunity. There's scientific research done, I mean, conclusive research done by Thai University for these independent smallholders in Thailand. They did an assessment of what they were doing prior to certification, and assessment to them after getting certification.
Mm-hmm.
The big jump in their earnings comes from productivity.
Yes.
So after certification, your productivity increases so much, your bottom line increases
by
20%.
Yes, but on that point, the UN Food and Agriculture Organization themselves have done a study on this Thai project, and they have found that actually the funds were probably better used in directly helping them with their estate management rather than on the actual certification process itself, and that, you know, it would not have been viable if not for foreign funding on this.
Correct. Now, I know the implementation agency, it was a German aid agency, right, who did this.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked them, why did they have to spend so much? Well, they said, who's done it before? They didn't know how to do it, so they spent a lot of time figuring out how to do it. So that's the high cost involved. So that's what I would say sunk in cost, right? It's learning cost.
Yeah.
But now, the learnings from that is used in Indonesia and Malaysia, and the cost is coming lower. And we already see in Indonesia, for example, the cost of certification for smallholders is going to be very low, much lower, by a factor of 10 maybe, Thai experience.
Okay.
They had to spend a lot of money learning how to do it.
Yeah.
Because nobody had done
it. But is that certification process absolutely necessary? Are you not better off just helping them run more efficient estates?
Well, I think people have to separate out. The certification is a tool to run estates, right?
Yeah.
It's the tool that ensures the running of estates can continue without you having dirty your hands year after year after year after year in that with the smallholders. Mm. So the smallholders have a self-help tool, and the self-help tool is certification, because now they have to monitor themselves, because people will come monitor them. They have to make sure their records are right. They have to show to these guys that they're actually improving the yields, reducing input costs, getting better deals, and also certification allows them premium market access.
So moving on with the other criteria that you're looking to pass at the Extraordinary General Meeting, the growing and milling process in itself is such that that very few highly skilled workers are needed, and therefore they're probably not very highly paid in that process.
At the production level?
At the production level.
Okay.
So do you think human rights policies will make a real difference to the quality of life of these workers?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a big thing. Especially, we have to look at what we do. We are a global standard, and we're very worried in areas where governance is low. They are the new frontiers of the palm oil industry right now, Africa, Latin America. So we have to look at all that in totality, what's happening in the world. And especially important in areas of post-conflict areas.
Mm-hmm.
We have received information that these RSPO is seen as a tool to probably help ensure self-governance of the industry in these post-conflict areas. So I really think human rights is a big issue that needs to be tackled.
Is there any, just on a very simplistic level, is there any talk of, say, minimum pay in the industry?
There's already talk of minimum pay in the industry. I think that's just already agreed on.
Right,
yeah.
Okay. So just for your casual labour, because a lot of them are not...
No. So there is already minimum pay now in industry that's agreed on, but not because of RSPO. It was the Malaysian government decided.
Okay, but then on this point, how would this address the issue of stateless people in the workforce, for example? If you were to say you shouldn't be using stateless people in your workforce, but if you look at the other side of the coin, these people who were previously able to earn a living working within the palm oil industry will now be shunned by members of the RSPO.
It's a catch 22. Nobody who brought up this human rights issue are thinking of marginalizing the stateless people. The issue now with the stateless people is they have also now children who are stateless.
Mm-hmm.
And the children who are stateless cannot get access to education, for example.
Mm.
And you are then on purpose marginalizing a sector, the future generation, who cannot get education.
Yep.
And they will revert to probably not so great things because they have no access to education. They will be forever marginalized. But it's a significant number. And how do you deal with that? Right?
But surely that's almost beyond the remit of the RSPO members.
Exactly.
It's more a governmental issue.
Which is why we say in these standards, in that particular aspect of our revised standards, we will have to form a working group. And it probably will include government to understand.
Okay.
I think, it's such a big issue that too many times it's swept under the carpet.
Yeah.
And, at that meeting the other day during the review, all the stakeholders agreed to this. I was shocked. I thought it was too big, I thought it was too big an issue for RSPO.
Yeah.
It can only give me more grey hairs, for example. But they thought it was worth a shot. They think it's a real issue. It's absolutely a real issue.
Mm.
Can we solve it? I don't know. But I'd like to say that we tried. And, the industry is a very strategic industry for Malaysia.
Mm.
If the industry feels that it needs to be tackled, I'm sure the Malaysian government will tackle it.
Well, moving on to the greenhouse gas issue. The model at RSPO relies on self-reporting and self-regulation. And reports on issues such as this are not independently verified generally, particularly on the sort of certified estate areas. You rely on them to report what they see. So does self-regulation actually work? Because, if you look back at global financial institutions, one might argue that actually, they've self-imploded on themselves.
Self-reporting and self-regulation, if you make it transparent enough, someone will catch you, right? Eventually. And that's how people get into a mess, banking industry included, right?
Mm.
I think the crux for us in how we approach the greenhouse gas is we have a tool that's developed by the RSPO to calculate these emissions. It's a standard tool. You plug in your numbers and then you get the result, right?
Okay.
Now, the certification body will then do a sampling of how you plugged in those numbers and then check on the ground whether those numbers are correct. And that's one way. And the certification body is a third-party certification body, so they shouldn't be influenced by the company in how they audit this.
Yeah.
So I guess that's one way. So, although we have systems designed in theory to be great, systems do break and do have flaws, and so then we have a complaint system to capture all those breaks and flaws.
Yeah.
And which we try also to deliver on that. And on top of that, if we have, people always ask, well, who's policing the policeman?
Yeah.
So we have also hired the policeman's policeman. So we have now an agency called Accreditation Systems International, who monitors the certification body. Okay. So they can come in, parachute down anytime they like, you know, to check on the certification body if he's doing a good job.
On that certification front, actually, we now have the ISPO, the Indonesian
Sustainable
standard.
Yeah.
And then MSPO has just come out.
Mm-hmm. Well, MSPO has not come out yet.
Officially. Well, rather they've announced their intention for MSPO. I mean, they're all slightly different, right? For Malaysia and Indonesia to be such large palm oil producers, does that make the RSPO itself redundant? Or are you looking to pull all of them together and come up with some kind of international standard here?
Well, the RSPO is the international standard, and the ISPO and MSPO are national standards. For us, and I've always maintained this right from the very beginning, my initial reaction to this was great. Why? First, let's start from the beginning, why I like it. Number one, years ago when you start talking about sustainability, everybody didn't know the word.
Mm.
Now you go to Indonesia, for example, every plantation
it's becoming
guy,
compulsory for them,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's mandatory.
Yeah.
So they know the word sustainability. That's one foot in the door, right?
Okay.
Then now, I think in Indonesia, the floor has been raised. So that makes it easier to jump over the bar of the RSPO certification.
Generally, critics of the palm oil industry claim that palm oil production is harmful to the global environment. I mean, the US Environmental Protection Agency published some results showing that palm oil biodiesel would only save 17% on CO2 emissions compared to fossil fuel. But subsequently, the world growth placed the CO2 emission savings at closer to 60%. You know, and it's already an established fact that palm oil is capable of producing 5 to 10 times more oil per hectare compared to other vegetable oils.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if we take a very cynical view on this, could it be that regions committed to 100% CSPO usage are also all seed-producing nations?
No.
What would you say to that?
No. I mean, the countries committing to 100%, right, Belgium, Netherlands. I mean, they do produce, but in small quantities. They rely a lot on imports. This whole thing about the conspiracy theory and all that, I wish people would wake up and smell the coffee, right?
But isn't there some form of protectionism going on?
Especially
on the American part, reporting those kind of numbers.
I don't know. Well, first of all, let me talk about those numbers. I don't know enough to talk about those numbers, but from what I understand, I've talked with the US State Department. They are waiting for scientific, conclusive counter-evidence to that. So that's my understanding.
Mm.
But I always tell people, you're so worried about protectionism and all that. It happens everywhere, including in Malaysia, right? Let's face it. Governments are responsible to their to their national industries, to their lobbyists who are based there, and there's going to be all sorts of protection. But you are selling stuff to them, so should you then cry that there's protectionism, or should you stay ahead of the curve and think, well, what's the next step they're going to do, and how am I going to sidestep this whole issue?
You're competing against a subsidized industry. Essentially, the oilseed industries are mostly subsidized by their national governments.
And that's what they say about Malaysian policies too.
What, that palm oil is a subsidized industry?
No, not palm oil, but...
Well, no, yeah, Malaysian policies aside, we are comparing the...
Absolutely. So what I'm trying to say... So it's nobody's going to roll out the red carpet for you.
Yes.
Right? Nobody's going to say, right, just sell your stuff. No. You have to know what the issue is coming out. And if you're any good at selling anything, you should know what your customer wants. And if your customer has certain issues, you need to be able to answer to those. Rather than saying, well, your oil's bad too.
Well,
that's
no,
not how you sell stuff.
Yes. If we take a holistic view on this, you know, for the good of the environment, well, there must be one that is better than the rest. Which one is it?
You know, I have the benefit of being on all sides of the coin. And my position is always this. Oil palm as a plant is superior than any other oil seed, right? Unfortunately, it's grown in the most biodiverse places on earth. But I also tell people, should you blame the plant or you should blame the developers? Because there are ways that if you go according to the RSPO rules, you can avoid this conflict and this biodiversity conflict and development. I keep telling people the only solution to unsustainable development of palm oil is sustainable development of palm oil, not no palm oil. My message is very clear. Do not say no palm oil, because no palm oil creates 10 times more problems somewhere else.
Are the NGOs out there to be persuaded? They don't seem to...
I always say to tell people, not only NGOs, but even, you know, industry or whatever, they don't know what they don't know. Some of them, basic things like they think they have to chop down a palm tree to drain out the oil. No, but you know, you may laugh, but for what, you know, from where they come from, it's very logical to think that way, right?
Because so, that's how the oil seeds
yeah,
work.
Yeah. So, okay. So it's a process of education. And I think that's where all of us have a role to play, right? I mean, you know, you should go to, this is how you harvest the thing. In order to be honest and be more appreciated by these kind of audience, you have to be brutally honest.
Mm.
You have to admit that there were some issues in the past. No, you're saying there's no deforestation. Come on, there's Google Earth now. You know, you go to a spot on Google Earth, you can turn back the dial 10 years,
yeah,
and you can see forest there, and you can turn back the dial forwards to now, and you see plantations. So it's useless to say there's no deforestation. My opinion is you go out there, you say, look, nobody knew the word biodiversity 10 years ago. Today they do, and players want to change.
Mm.
In the past, we screwed up. This is how we're going to do it in the forward. And that is believable.
Thank you for joining us. That was Daryl Weber of the RSPO, BFM 89.9.
The BFM Breakfast Grill was brought to you by the CIMB Group, Southeast Asia's leading universal bank. BFM 89.9, the business station.